Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to My Millennial Career. My name is Shelley Johnson. I'm a HR consultant at Boldside, where I help leaders build amazing teams. If you want to invest in your team, or maybe you want to reset the culture, maybe there's been some challenges with your team and you think it's time for a bit of a reset, DM me on LinkedIn and let's chat about how we can work together. Today's episode is so important. We're talking about well-being, and this is a really big issue at the moment for so many employees, with so much fatigue and burnout happening. And we talk a bit about burnout in Australia, and I'm joined by a good friend of mine, an absolute legend, Phil Wolf, who is a workplace well-being specialist at Connects Health. And Phil does two things at Connects. He upskills workforces to help them be healthy and well under any circumstances, and he works with organizations to optimize the circumstances to make it easier for their team and their employees to be healthy and well. With over 25,000 individual consultations and a decade of experience designing workplace wellbeing programs, from tech startups to global pharmaceutical brands and everything in between, Phil is one of the most experienced workplace wellbeing specialists in Australia. We work together on this episode. Phil really simplifies our understanding of well-being and talks about the practical strategies of how you build well-being at work. If your organization needs help in this space, you need to hit Phil up on LinkedIn, because his business do amazing things in this space. Can't wait for you to hear everything he has to say. Let's get into it. Okay, I wanted to talk to you about well-being. It's been ages since we've done any episodes on well-being at work. And for me, Phil, one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on the show was because of your insight, how many organizations you're working with in this space around well-being, but also because of one of the big challenges we're seeing for our listeners at the moment is this idea of burnout. How do you manage wellness? How do you... having a really good career, but it not coming at the expense of your health. And I don't know, is this something that you're seeing in your space at the moment?
Yeah, 100%. That's basically all we see in this space. And it's such a tough balance to strike. Exactly what you said, how do you have this amazing career and also balance your well-being at the same time? And there's no one answer to it, but essentially it boils down to what resources we have and what requirements are asked of us. And we'll, as we go along through this talk, I'm sure we're going to reference that quite a lot, but basically that's what it boils down to. What are our resources and what requirements are asked of us? Do we have enough resources to fit those requirements? That's really the balance that we're all trying to strike.
Yeah, that's such a, and I feel like that's a tension between the resources we have available to us to manage, you know, stress, manage the pressure of work, but then those demands. And I like how you frame it as requirements rather than demands, because I think we need to work out, are these things being demanded, or do we just feel like they're demanded of us in our workplace? Before we kind of dig into that, I want to know, because I'm like, what does well-being even mean? Like, I'm like, do I know what well-being means? I have no idea. Like, I feel like it's this ethereal idea out there in the world, but I'm like, how would you define it?
Yeah, it is. It is this, it's a notion. It's a concept. It's so incredibly subjective that we don't actually have one definition. I was asked by an organization that we're working with at the beginning of last year, Phil, do you have a definition of well-being that we can use for our strategy, on our strategy doc? And I was like, oh crap, no, I don't. I don't actually have like a sentence that I can give you that will encapsulate it for both me and for you because it is so incredibly subjective. But nevertheless, I gave it a shot. So what makes sense to me is well-being is a state of being physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, spiritually, and financially well and in balance, and maintaining a high level of control over the inputs that affect these different elements. That for me is what well-being really boils down to. It's balance and its agency over the things, those elements in that balance. So we can't possibly be firing on all cylinders in our physical and mental and social and emotional and financial health all at once, but those things all balance each other out. And if we feel like we're actually able to control those things and we're able to have a great deal of input and agency over those things, then we have a sense of well-being. And that's, for me at least, that's what it boils down to. And that's the most practical example or the most practical definition that I've thought of or come across, because it not only in some ways, well, in I think a good enough way defines it, but it gives us some sort of practical elements that we can then work on. It's no good having this, like you said, ethereal concept if we have no practical way to influence it. So for me, that's essentially what it boils down to.
I love that definition so much. I love how it captures all the different parts of your life as well. It's financial, it's spiritual, it's your sense of well-being at work as well. I guess I'm just thinking, and I'm trying to apply this lens to my own life as you're talking, going, okay, how do I feel like this is playing out right now in my own life? One of the things maybe I've got stuck on is defining well-being by what it isn't. So like that sense of, oh, if there's an absence of stress, then I'm in a good place. Like what do you think that is in us of like, oh, we define well-being by certain things not being in the mix. Like if I'm not stressed or I'm not uncomfortable, is that like a common problem? Is it just that we don't have enough of an idea of what well-being looks like practically?
Yeah, I think we don't pay enough attention to it. Like most things in life, we don't draw enough, we don't have enough awareness around it, and we don't actually focus on what it is and what it is to us. We have this vague notion, but we don't actually take the time to stop and think, okay, what is well-being to me? Is it the absence of something? Is it the presence of something? Is it something I feel? Is it something I am? I think in like most things in life, we're not consciously aware of what it means to us. And I'm glad you bring that up in terms of stress and comfort. I don't think the presence of stress negates the presence of well-being, and I don't think comfort is a direct corollary for well-being either. I think you can absolutely, and I think you necessarily have stress and discomfort as parts of a balanced well-being. I think we tend to demonize and villainize stress, but it's not a bad thing. It comes back to our resources and requirements. If our requirements are constantly too great for our resources, then we feel overwhelmed. It's not so much the presence of stress, it's the presence of too much stress chronically, and we start to get overwhelmed. If we have the correct resources, or that balance is being struck, and if our requirements are just above our resources or just under our resources, then that stress is actually a good thing. That's where we grow. We're not overwhelmed. We're actually pushed to do better and to be better. And comfort, I think, it's a misunderstood thing. Too much comfort will kill us, and too much comfort is a bad thing. Discomfort is not necessarily a bad thing in and of itself. Sometimes we want to feel comfortable, but sometimes we need to feel uncomfortable in order to feel accomplished, in order to feel like we're moving forward, like we're growing. Like going to the gym, lifting weights is uncomfortable. Running is uncomfortable. Managing our minds is uncomfortable. Having doing a presentation in front of 1,000 people is uncomfortable, but they're all very, very good things. I think, yeah, we view discomfort as this thing that we should avoid, but it's something that we should embrace. And yeah, a presence of a great deal of comfort is not necessarily a presence of a great deal of well-being.
Wow, that is so good. Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you said that. I want to know, how do you work out whether it's good stress or bad stress that you're experiencing?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. It goes to, is this stress serving me? And is this stress always present? And what level of control do I have over it? And it really goes back to that level of control. If the stress is constant and it's being seemingly put on you by external forces and you feel like you don't have any control over it, that tends to be bad stress, de-stress. If you feel in danger, particularly consistently, that's de-stress. If you're feeling like you're being pushed and more is required of you, so you're meeting those requirements and you're growing and learning, that's eustress. That's at the top of the bell curve, and that's actually good for us. It's the difference between when an athlete performs and thrives in an environment that is very, very stressful and when one gets the yips and crumbles. We have to strike that balance between eustress and de-stress. And I think it's got a great deal to do with, again, how much awareness and how much conscious thought we bring to it and how able we feel to react to it and adapt to it. It's different for each of us. What is de-stress for one person is eustress for another. And for a third person, it's completely neutral. So it's a tough question. There is no one answer. And I feel like we're going to have a lot of those throughout this conversation, which is in health and well-being, it's not a sexy thing to say. It depends. It depends is not is not fun. It's not definitive. It doesn't get you likes and follows and subscribers, but it's nonetheless the way things are. To most questions, the answer is always going to be, it depends.
It goes to how personal this stuff is, right? Like, it's so unique to the individual. It's kind of, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who trains for marathons, and I'm like, I could not run 1.6 Ks. Like, I just don't want to do that. I have no desire. But she's like all into doing her marathons. And I think that level for me would be distressing. Like, if I was to do a 40K run, I'd be like, that is distressing. Whereas for her, that's that eustress, like that healthy stress. And we've got to work out for us, what is that zone that we need to be in where we have a healthy level of discomfort, but it doesn't cause us to go into flight or fight mode or into our sympathetic nervous system, which is so inherently personal because we're all so different. We have different strengths. We have different ways of operating. I've noticed in this conversation, Phil, you've already used the word balance quite a few times. I have this issue with balance, and it could be because I'm so bad at it. Like, I have a problem with balance because for however long, I reckon it's been, what, nearly 15 years we've been talking about work-life balance. I don't have work-life balance. I can't find it. I don't believe, and so I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I don't believe in work-life balance. I'm trying to find more of a state of flow, and that might be why my well-being is not very good. I don't know, but I just want to know from you, how do you find this balance? Like, I haven't been able to uncover it, and I know a lot of our listeners will be nodding their heads along going, yeah, I can't find that. And is it even a thing?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, and I'm glad you used that term specifically. I also use the term work-life balance because it's very easy to understand and it provides clarity on what's being referenced, but it doesn't encapsulate the whole thing. It's flawed in a lot of ways because it implies that there's these two dichotomous entities that need to be separated at all times or else both will suffer. I completely disagree with that. I inherently disagree with that. When work is done well, it should enhance our lives, and our activities outside of what's considered work should enhance the work itself. Now, when I say balance, that's, again, it's completely subjective, it's completely individualized. What's balanced to one is overwhelmed to another, and it's underworked to a third. So we have to strike that within ourselves. And essentially, what is practical and what is sustainable and what is enjoyable and useful to us. So as an entrepreneur, you would know this, work permeates every part of your life. And I work with my partner. So on the weekends, we'll be going for a walk, we'll be having coffee or breakfast, and we'll go, oh, what about this? And what about this idea and this and that thing that we did? This is how we can make it better. And I think this didn't work and that will work. And it permeates every single part of our lives. Now, we don't have a distinct separation between what's considered work and what you would consider non-work, but that's good. It actually enhances our well-being. So it's not work-life balance, it's life balance. It's how do you balance all of the requirements of life, because work is just another requirement of life. It's not work and life. They're together. They are one thing. They're just different parts of the one whole. So I think for most of us, striking that work-life balance is not so much about how do we separate them. Sometimes it is, but how do we make them work together in a way that is useful and enjoyable and practical for each of us? And that does come down to, I think, in its most simplistic sense, separating work tasks from our regular life. I think that's absolutely essential. And there's different ways that we can do that, but we don't necessarily need to separate work and life and have them fighting against each other. We can instead have them working with each other to enhance our overall well-being. So, yeah, I take exception with the term work-life balance, but the concept of integrating work into our lives to make it useful and practical for us, I think that's what we should be striving for, really.
I love that term of integration, like how do those things integrate well? And then the other thing I love that you said there, Phil, was around sustainability. For me, that term really resonates because I often find myself saying things like when I'm in that overwhelm mode where the requirements and my resources don't align, I'm like, oh, the requirements are up here and my resources are well below that. I find myself going into the overwhelm mode and I can hear myself saying, like often say to Sam, my husband, this is not sustainable. And I don't have the energy for this, or I don't have the capacity. And I can hear that language coming out. I don't think about balance, because one of the things for me, Phil, I find when I'm in a healthy zone, work really energizes me. And I think a lot of our listeners who are listening to a careers podcast are energized by work. But I think the question is the level of investment that I'm putting into my work, does it feel sustainable in the long run? And what are the practices that we need to fill up our energy reserves? And so I'd just like to know, like, what do you do personally? And what do you recommend to you work with some huge clients all around Australia about how they build this well-being at work. What are the things that we can do to build our energy reserves and create those sustainable practices?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. So sustainable work is a buzz term at the moment. It's growing, which I think is absolutely fantastic. We have sustainable economic practices, environmental practices, but sustainability should absolutely apply to our human elements. What is sustainable for us? And at the moment, and for a long time, what we've been trying to do is push ourselves, see how far we can push ourselves, see how much productivity, how much energy, how much effort we can draw out of ourselves and squeeze every last little drop until we break. And that's essentially, it's one of the reasons people are burning out, because they're just trying to push harder and harder and harder. And then eventually giving 100% effort. 100% effort gives you 100% results. Then 100% effort gives you 90% results, and then 80, and then 70, and 60, until you burn out. You're still giving 100% of effort, but you're getting diminishing returns over time. What is the level that you can give sustainably in order to perform at a high level, basically indefinitely. And that falls to each of us and to companies themselves to find that level. What are the practices that need to be integrated into your life in order to allow you to keep performing at this level? Now, there's so much that we can take from elite sport in this area. I think elite sport is leaps and bounds ahead of us, ahead of business in terms of how they approach things, because what they've realized decades and decades ago is that people are their product. And that is true across any industry. But elite sport, it's a lot more apparent. If the person breaks down, you have no product. If you're a sprinter and the sprinter breaks down, there's no race. You can't do anything. If you're a tennis player, you get injured, there's no tennis match, you're out. It's the same in business. If your people break down, you have no business. But we're lagging behind elite sport in that way. So how can we make ourselves more like elite athletes and able to perform at a higher level indefinitely? And I realize I did go off a little bit on a tangent generally, and you asked me specifically what I do. So I'm very, very acutely aware of the things that give me energy and that take energy from me. About 6 years ago, I did experience burnout fairly severely, I guess, because I was pushing myself way, way, way too hard. And I wasn't paying, whilst I was healthy and I've always been a healthy person, I was pushing myself far more than than my recovery. My requirements were far greater than my resources, and that was a big problem for me. So I was forced to become acutely aware of the things that take energy from me and the things that give energy to me. So for me personally, I pay a lot of attention to when I'm feeling like I need recovery. And I don't necessarily call it rest that much. It's recovery. It's active recovery. What do I need to do right now to rebuild my energy reserves? And how long do I need to do it in order to go into the next work bout as well as I possibly can? So for me, sleep is an absolute necessity. Well, it is for all of us, but it's an absolute priority. I will forego many, many things for my sleep. I hear people working into the night to 1, 2, 3 o'clock, and they're doing it on a regular basis. That is not for me. Absolutely not for me. Nothing encroaches on my sleep pattern in a normal day. There are exceptions, very occasionally exceptions, but sleep I prioritize over everything. My next priority is exercise. If I don't exercise, I start going crazy, whether it be going to the gym or playing tennis or rock climbing or just going for a walk with my partner by the ocean. I must get out and I must move. It gives me energy in the short term, mentally and physically, and it increases my capacity to produce energy in the long term. And that's what exercise gives us. I think it's the single greatest intervention that everyone isn't doing at the moment. So few of us move anywhere near as much as we should. And what it does for us is exactly that. It gives us energy in the short term and increases our capacity to produce energy in the long term. I try and eat well. That's secondary for me. I get the nutrients that I'm supposed to, but I don't strictly watch my diet. As long as I'm sleeping well and I'm exercising, then I'm feeling well, I'm feeling good. And then I pay very, very close attention to when I need to recover. I'd so much rather take a break for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and then come back to work refreshed than try and push through and give myself diminishing returns, or stop work for the night and have a good rest, have a good sleep, and then get up ready to go the next day, because I know I can produce so much more quality output in a shorter space of time when I'm feeling energized, when I'm feeling well. So why bash my head up against a brick wall when I can rest and then do it so much better the next day? So those are the keys for me: sleep, exercise, and noticing when I need to recover and giving myself that, not feeling guilty about it. That was the trick, to stop feeling guilty about my recovery and seeing it as an absolute necessity to my performance rather than feeling lazy or feeling like I should be doing more. Getting over that guilt was 100% the hardest part, and still is, honestly, still is.
Wow, that's massive. I so relate to that feeling of guilt if you need that break and feeling like, oh, I can't keep focusing on this thing I'm doing. I need a break, but that must mean I'm not working hard, or that must mean I'm lazy. I have like 50 questions off that thing that you've just shared, because I'm like, oh, I want to go this angle. I want to go this angle. Okay. First question, active recovery versus rest. Tell me more about that.
So active recovery is something that you know gives you energy. So rest could be sitting on the couch watching Netflix. Active recovery could be going to get a massage or exercising or meditating or going for a walk, something that you know is going to boost your energy, not just not take your energy, but something that's going to boost your energy.
That's an aha moment, because I've noticed in myself when I feel low on energy, the things that I should do, like I love walking. It's one of the ways that I re-energize, like bushwalking. I like being out in nature, but I don't do that sometimes when I'm tired and I'm like, I know that thing will give me energy, but I'm exhausted. And so then I'll just veg out and then I won't feel any better.
Yeah. And that's the exact difference. Rest doesn't take energy from you. Active recovery gives you energy. So and it's tough to do that. It's tough to get yourself over that tiny little hump into active recovery, from rest into active recovery, because it does require energy to get you energy and a little bit of willpower just to get you over that first hump. And as soon as you're doing it, you're like, oh my God, yes, I love it. I love walking in nature. I love reading. I love doing this instead of just vegging out. But as soon as you're over that little hump, then yeah, that's the key. The hardest part of working out is putting your shoes on. After that, everything's easy.
It's amazing to me hearing you talk about this stuff and realizing I'm just like nodding along going, oh my gosh, I really need to hear this message right now around how do you build high-performing practices and do it sustainably. And I think this key of active recovery to me is like light bulbs going off. You talked about your burnout experience leading you to figure out what energizes you. I don't think many of us know what energizes us. I still think I'm learning this slowly, like so slowly. But I want to know, like, how do you figure out, for any listeners who are like, well, I don't know what energizes me. And sometimes the things that we think give us energy actually don't. Like I used to watch, I hardly watch TV now, but I used to watch a lot of Netflix thinking that was how I would like recover. And I found over time, I'm like, no, that just kind of switches my brain on more. Like reading is really something that I do to re-energize. But how do people who haven't figured this out, what are the things they can do to work out what re-energizes them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's a good point. I watch a lot of Netflix and streaming services. I love it. Like I'm a huge movie buff, TV buff. I actually really, really enjoy it. It gives me energy and it's one of my favorite ways to chill out. My partner as well, she loves it. And we will discuss it during and after. And yeah, we're nerds in that way. So you and I differ in that way. It's about drawing your awareness to thinking about the things that you do and how did you feel after it? Did it give you energy? Did it make you feel good? Did it just help you to zone out for a little bit? And actually just thinking about the things we do each day is the first step. Second step is trial and error with mindfulness. Now, people hear the term mindfulness and they think woo-woo, but it's not. It's attention, it's awareness, it's curiosity about the things that we're actually doing. We don't have anywhere near enough mindfulness about the things that we're doing. If we did, if we were mindful of the things that we were doing and that we wanted to do, then none of this would be a question. It would just be, you would have the answer immediately. that none of us, myself included, anywhere near mindful enough. So trial and error of things that you think will work and being mindful and asking questions to yourself about, did it work? Was that good for me? Was it bad? Was it neutral? What can I try next? We're not mindful or curious enough about the things that we do and about the things that will actually help us. So get out there and try a whole bunch of different things. If the person next door says, oh, you got to try this, it was great, yeah, give it a shot. See if it works for you. If you read something, absolutely, go for it. Try mountain bike riding, try kayaking, try, I don't know, mushroom farming, whatever you want to do, just try everything.
I thought you were just going to be like, try mushrooms. I'm like, yeah, go for whatever you want. Try it. Try a range of things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mushrooms in themselves. Yeah. Well, we won't get into that, but there's a lot more research going into that. So, yeah.
Right. Topic for another. Totally. Absolutely. So much happening in that space at the moment. We're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about resilience, because I know this is something that you speak a lot about in so many organizations. Let's go to a break and then we'll come back in a sec. If you want to grow in your career, I just wanted to remind you about our book, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Glenn James and I have written this book to help you with any kind of career crisis, but also those things that you want, like getting a promotion, making more money, moving into a leadership role, or if it's time to quit your job. You can find our book wherever you get good books from, or you can listen on the audiobook, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Now let's get back to the show.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right. So, you are super passionate about this idea of resilience. And I think for a lot of us, I know, Phil, that you're super passionate about this idea of resilience. And I know at the moment for Australians, many employees, and I think millennials are so in this bracket, have felt burnout, gone through a burnout experience. And we're finding, well, how do we bounce back from those difficult times? How do we build our resilience to stress, our resilience at work? And I know that research, I can't remember exactly where Australians sat, but I thought it was like third in the world for the highest rates of burnout. Did you see that research? Am I making up something?
No, you're not making that up. It depends which poll you use, but if you use the Microsoft Work Trends Index, where number one, we were 62%. The global average was 48%. So we are, and I absolutely don't doubt that other surveys would have us up near the top as well. A number of them that I've seen do. Yeah, we are right at the top for burnout. We're rife with it, absolutely.
So what is there a connection between building resilience and avoiding burnout? Like, do those things have a relationship?
They definitely do. They 100% do. But I think the concept of resilience and the way that it's spoken about from in organizational and a corporate perspective is it heaps all of the blame onto the person, and organizations will often point to people and say, you're not resilient enough. You need to be more resilient. back in my day, this and that. Well, yeah, it's true that we saw that we documented less burnout years and years ago, but the requirements of life were also a great deal less. There is so much vying for our attention these days that it can become overwhelming very, very quickly. It's like I always used to question why F1 cars needed so much maintenance. Every few laps, they need crews to work on them. The engines are blowing up. I'm like, well, my Corolla goes just fine. Like, I get it serviced once a year and it's all good. Well, yeah, but the F1 car is performing at a much, much higher rate. There's a lot more required of an F1 car than there is of my 1986 red Corolla. but I think that's a key difference. 20 years ago, there was not this much going on in the world, and we weren't aware of all of this stuff going on. There wasn't so many things pulling us in so many different directions. So the requirements of life have most certainly increased. And if you just look at it from a financial perspective, it is much more difficult for people collectively. I'm not saying that people can't absolutely excel and become rich and do X, Y, Z, but collectively, the economic situation is far more dire now than it was 20 years ago. So there's a lot more pressure coming from there. There's a lot more requirements coming from there. So it's not as simple as you need to be more resilient, and it's not as simple as you need to demand less of us. Like anything, the answer is somewhere in the middle. And again, that's not what people want to hear, because everyone thinks that their perspective is correct, but it lies somewhere in the middle. But going back to our resilience, it's a skill. Like health and well-being, the people who are healthy and well generally are the ones that have a greater skill set allowing them to be healthy and well, and they're applying that skill set to make themselves healthy and well. Resilience is the same. It is a skill that's strengthened through training and application, and it's enhanced with perspective as well. Perspective is an enormous part of it. And when we see ourselves as resilient people and we see obstacles as challenges to grow from, we tend to add to this skill set. And when we see ourselves as victims of circumstance and we feel powerless to change those circumstances, then our resilience tends to erode away. So it is a balance. Organizations should be looking at, are these requirements too much? And individuals should be looking at, how do I become more resilient? How do I add to my mental and psychological skill set? How do I recognize and manage stress? How do I gain more or a different perspective? How do I employ and apply appropriate mental models? How do I shift my mindset? How do I adapt to new inputs and new ways of thinking? It's a constant upskilling that we should all be going through. So it is a balance from both ways. But yeah, our resilience is a skill set. And like any skill in the world can be learned and mastered if we apply ourselves to it.
Are there any practical ways that you see people, because for our listeners, they might not be a leader in the organization. I mean, some are, but let's say we've got listeners who are like, I don't know that I can change my employer's expectations of what's required. How would you recommend they build their resources or build their resilience? Like, are there practical steps that you work with your clients on to do this?
Yes. So the things that I mentioned, definitely. Recognizing the causes of stress to you and recognizing your reactions to that stress, and how can you make that stress work for you? How can you gain a different perspective on things? Is this really a life and death scenario, or is this just another thing that's happening, and can you react to it in a different way? I think a very, very useful thing is to learn about and employ different mental models, essentially different ways of viewing the world. and applying those to your life. So it's all about how we see and react to the things that are happening around us. Because as you would know, stress doesn't exist in the world. There's no such thing as stress. There are stressors. So what is stressful for one person is completely neutral to another, and it's actually beneficial to another person. It's how do we perceive and react to the things that are happening? And the first step to that, I mean, this is a very, very complex process, and it's different for each of us. So there's no quick answer to it. But the first step is being mindful of what's happening and being mindful of how we're reacting to what's happening. Is it useful to us the way we're reacting? And if not, how do we change that? That's essentially what it boils down to. Is this useful to us? And if not, how can we change that? That happens in literally an infinite number of ways, but that's what we each need to start doing. And that's taking it all in on ourselves outwardly to change that situation. I would say communication. Communication is the most underutilized magical tool that we have, and we're not using it anywhere near as much as we should. If there is a situation that isn't serving us or that we want to change, we have to communicate about it. There's so many people, actually, an example, we consult with a lot of people, and I still consult personally with a lot of people. There was a mother, she's a single mother of three children who works full time. Those three children, two of them are almost grown, another is in her teens, and she was really struggling because they weren't helping at home. And she's obviously working full time. She's got so much to do at home. She was feeling overwhelmed. And I said, well, it's not great that they're not helping you when you ask them to. And she said, well, I don't really ask them to. I think it's just easier to do the things myself. And that's what it boiled down to. She was not communicating her expectations with her kids, wasn't communicating how they could contribute and help. That was her task for the week. And as soon as she did it, things changed immediately because the kids now recognized that there was an issue and they could work together to solve it. An issue that she had been dealing with for years and years because of lack of communication. And it's the same for workplaces. If an employee is feeling that there's an issue and they haven't communicated that to their employer, then the employer has no way of knowing. If they do communicate it and something's still not being done, that's a separate issue. But most times, if you communicate effectively, then you can find a resolution. So, yeah, it's working inwardly with ourselves, but outwardly, communicate if we're not doing it anywhere near as much as we should.
And that activity of having some of those difficult conversations with your employer, that in and of itself is resilience building, because it's a level of discomfort, but it's a healthy thing to do, even though it's hard to have those conversations. I'm just imagining right now people listening going, okay, here's where I feel. I feel like the requirements on me are greater than my resources, and I need to go and talk to my boss to say, look, like, these kind of demands or these requirements, I don't know that we're going to be able to meet them for these reasons. But I can see how people wouldn't want to have that conversation, because there's a level of vulnerability in saying, I don't know that I have the capacity for that right now. And it's like this thing of admitting, I don't know that I can do it. And I, for whatever reason, ego maybe, insecurity, but we don't want to do that. We don't want to say, and I know so many examples, and part of my own burnout experience was because I didn't ask for help. I didn't raise, I can't meet these requirements. I'm not coping. Like, those kinds of conversations are really exposing and vulnerable, but I can see how they're very resilience building as well. And they enable us to get that well-being back in our lives, because if we don't have them, no one's going to know. Like, no one's a mind reader.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's, yeah, communication, talking to people is like being a mind reader without having to sift through all the weird sex stuff that people think about all day. But you're dead right. Those conversations are really, really difficult. It goes to two things for me. Firstly, safety. How much safety is there? Comfort and safety, they're two very different things. They are related, but they're very, very different. Speaking up to your employer about a situation that's not serving you or that's really troubling you is uncomfortable, but feeling like you have the safety to do that is incredibly important. If you feel like if you speak up, you'll be fired, that's not safety. That's a terrible situation, and that's a whole other thing in itself. So recognizing that safety and comfort are two different things. And if you have the safety or perceive you have the safety to do that, then the question becomes, which is more uncomfortable, having that conversation, which could last for 2 minutes or 5 minutes or a couple of weeks. Is that more uncomfortable or less uncomfortable than things continuing the way they are right now? So if you don't say anything, you can keep going like this for the next 2 years. If you do say something, you might feel uncomfortable for the next 2 minutes, but at least it'll be out there. So, yeah, it's that. It's just biting the bullet and doing it in most situations, because that small amount of discomfort, if you can bring yourself to do that, you could save yourself an enormous amount of discomfort down the line.
All right, Phil, this has been so good. I reckon we'll have to do a part two because I have so many more questions that I'm like inverted commas asking for a friend, and the friend is me. But I just want to ask one more question because I think you've raised a really good point around what happens when the environment that you're working in is either not safe or your employer isn't promoting well-being. But I think there's a tension, and from my angle as a HR person, there's this tension between what's the responsibility of the employee and what's the responsibility of the employer when it comes to well-being. So I want you to answer this question because it's a big one.
It is.
Who is responsible?
It is a massive one. And there's, I think, like a lot of things in this area, we've got a blame game happening. The employer is saying it's up to the employee. Ultimately, the employee is saying, no, it's on you. And God, like everything, it is in the middle. It's a shared responsibility. Neither and both are 100% in charge. Now, the workplace absolutely is responsible for providing an environment that is safe. Now, that's always been true of the physical environment, and it's now legislated that it's true of the psychological environment as well, which is fantastic. So they have to create an environment that is, first of all, safe. And workplaces are doing that and then saying, well, beyond that, everything else is up to you. In a very real sense, that may be true, that every single person is ultimately responsible for their own well-being. They have agency over their actions, over what they do and they don't do. So your well-being is your responsibility. But having said that, workplaces benefit enormously from having workers who are healthy and well. So whether it's their responsibility or not to provide an environment that goes above and beyond to help workers be healthy and well, it is their problem. If they have workers who are not healthy and well, that is a huge problem. If they have workers who are healthy and well, that is an enormous benefit. So it may not be their responsibility, but it is well within their interest to create that environment. And that's essentially what I've modeled my entire company around. We work from the ground up and from the inside out. So we work with staff to increase their health and well-being skill sets to allow them to be healthy and well under any circumstances. And we work with the organizations to improve those circumstances to make it easier for people to be healthy and well. So when you work on it from both directions like that, you start to compound the benefits and you share the responsibility between these two groups who really should be working harmoniously. They should be working together, driving towards what will improve things for both of them, better health and well-being for the employee, better productivity and output for the company, and easier easier operations, lower costs, better essentially everything. So instead of pointing fingers and saying, it's your responsibility, no, it's your responsibility, say, how can we work together to make this the best that it can possibly be? Because as an employer, it may not be your responsibility, but it absolutely is your problem if you have workers who are unwell. So the ways to do that, I know we do have to wrap up, but upskilling your workers in health and well-being, in resilience, in health fundamentals, in how to be healthy and well under any circumstances, creating an environment where those skills are easily applied, creating a culture of well-being where doing the thing that will make you healthy and well is the accepted and encouraged thing, putting the person before the work and not constantly putting the work before the person. Sometimes work does have to come first, but more often than not, it should be the person that comes first, and then they'll give you better work. And communicate more than you think you should, because if you're doing it more than you think you should, it's still not enough. So yeah, it's a shared responsibility, and there's so much that we can all do to add to that and to make it work for us. So yeah, we should stop pointing fingers and start working together.
What a beautiful way to close out this conversation. Phil, thank you so much. And I just want to say to anyone listening who's a leader in a business or who is working in an organization that knows that they need to have a better focus on well-being, I want you to reach out to Phil. Phil, what is your how can people get in touch with you? Is it LinkedIn? What's the best way?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, we've got all the channels. We've got everything. We've got our website and our forms and everything that people can get in touch with us. Just go on my LinkedIn. It'll teach you everything you need to know about me, about my company, about what we do, about how to make workplace well-being practical. It's the best way. You'll get to know me before you ever have to speak to me. And if you like that, then yeah, send me a DM, send me a connection request. LinkedIn is, yeah, it's me. It's me on a page and my company. So that's the best way.
Amazing. So everyone, jump on, DM Phil, get to know him, and hit up your boss, hit up your organization to invest in well-being, because as Phil said, it's a win-win. It's a win for your employees, but ultimately the sell is it's a win for the organization's performance. So get on it, make it happen. If you enjoyed the show, give us a 5-star rating and review and share this with a friend. Thank you, Phil, for hanging out. So good to chat.
Thanks, Shell. And yeah, look forward to coming back.
We acknowledge the Awabakal people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
We love learning how to do all things well, which is why we have a bunch of different podcasts on a variety of topics. So go and check out My Millennial Investor, My Millennial Money Professional, My Millennial Property, My Millennial Money, My Millennial Daily, and Retire Right. Find these wherever you get your podcasts.